Before we start this episode of Conversations with Kenyatta, I'm excited to tell you about my new partnership with Audible. Listeners can go to www.audibletrial.com/Kenyatta to receive a free 30-day trial. Audible is a wonderful resource with audiobooks for every reader. It even has titles from authors that have been on my podcast, such as Dr. Dan Bouck's Democracy's Data and Gail Lukasik's White Like Her. And please note that this is an affiliate link, so I may receive a commission with no cost to you, just a free trial with so many wonderful titles. And I love to read. But with that, here's this week's episode of Conversations with Kenyatta. Welcome to episode 17 of Conversations with Kenyatta. Today, I'm joined by Dr. Malcolm Wortlaw from the University of Georgia. Dr. Wortlaw is known for his research in banking and savings for newly emancipated people. Dr. Wortlaw, thank you so much for joining Conversations with Kenyatta. I discovered your research, actually, while looking for information on the Freedmen's Bank. And while doing that, I kind of got obsessed one weekend and printed out your research, put it aside, and thought at some point I'd want to have you as a guest on the show. So thank you for being here today. But please describe for the audience sort of your background and research interest.
Sure. And thank you again for inviting me on the show. I really appreciate it. And it's nice that our efforts to try and, you know, make some of our research and our broader research goals public caught people's attention. So I'm maybe a little different, I think, from at least some of your previous podcast guests that I've heard, which I very much appreciate. I'm actually a researcher in finance, in financial economics within the business school, in particular in the business school at the Terry School of Business at the University of Georgia. Historically, most of my research has been in modern era things, so kind of issues in banking, some work that I've done on things like corporate financing issues and its impact on the investments in workplace safety and things like that, in a modern context. And so that's what I do. And then a few years ago, I had a PhD student who came across this really interesting old microfilm and the fact that it exists, a microfilm of some of these records, these passbook records of the Freedmen's Bank and Trust. And she was interested in doing some sort of research that was in the scope of banking and financial economics that we do. And that was what spawned the project. And in the process, we ended up digging into an enormous number of old records and digitizing several of the records ourselves, utilizing, I know you've had conversations with Tom at FamilySearch.org, which was an enormous research, and learning quite a bit about it ourselves, and trying to coax a lot of these genealogical records into broad sample data sets that we could say something about in the context of the kinds of economic research that we do. And so that's how the whole project came about. And in the process, I think, you know, we felt that we'd done so much work to try and process existing records, to clean existing records, and to digitize new records, that we wanted to make those efforts broadly available to anyone who might use them, whether they be economics researchers like ourselves or, you know, potentially just people who are interested in genealogical issues as well.
So you mentioned we're talking about the Freedmen's Bank as it's known, but it's actually the Freedmen's Savings and Trust.
That's correct.
What exactly was the Freedmen's Savings and Trust?
So the Freedmen's Savings and Trust was a private bank that was, it was essentially a savings bank that was chartered in 1865 as a quasi-philanthropic enterprise to service savings bank accounts, primarily to newly freed slaves in the immediate aftermath of the Civil War. So initially primarily focusing on people who were in black regiments who were coming out of the Civil War, and then broadly expanded to become this enormous savings bank. I think oftentimes people don't fully appreciate the scope of the bank in its full context. Today, you know, these days it's, you know, we think of it quite standard to have this big national bank with a bunch of national branches. That was fairly unusual back in the 1860s and 1870s. So the fact that this was a bank that had 30 some odd branches and this enormous geographical reach, and that it interacted with a fairly sizable percentage of the African-American population is meaningful. So this was the enterprise, the Freedmen's Savings and Trust. As I mentioned, it was a private enterprise. So it wasn't directly affiliated with the Freedmen's Bureau. And the name, I think, was sort of, at least in part, kind of meant to evoke that. And again, it was a philanthropic enterprise, but, you know, as a financial institution, it's sort of always subject to, you know, kind of to issues in management and regulation. And as time went on, the bank expanded quite rapidly. It ended up, you know, drawing in, like I said, an enormous number of depositors. And as the bank expanded, and this was not, you know, incredibly unusual for banks at the time, particularly in the Wild West days when things were just very heavily unregulated, the things started to teeter and to sort of start making these questionable investments in real estate in the Washington, D.C. area. Hmm. And again, all of their lending customers were whites. So African Americans were their depositor base by and large, but not their lending base. And again, it was a savings bank. So with savings banks, both then and now, the primary goal was supposed to be to simply take these and invest them in safe asset classes like bonds and things. And, you know, just like for the people like me who remember the savings and loans crisis, mm-hmm. you know, sort of corruption sets in and there's this change in strategy. People sort of make choices to try and prop up certain things with riskier investments. And then the entire thing collapsed in 1874.
Okay. I appreciate you bringing that up. And I want to dig a little bit deeper into that, Dr. Wardlaw, because as a genealogist, right, we look at the Freedmen's Bank simply for kind of the, just those little cards you see, just the information that has, you know, where they were born, their parents, their siblings. We really don't dig deep into the actual kind of behind the scenes, right, of what actually happened to the Freedmen's Bank. And you mentioned the lending to whites in Washington, D.C. Talk a little bit more about that and why you think that was done and how that impacted, you know, most of the depositors and their assets in the bank.
Sure. And, you know, like I said, this is not an atypical story for savings banks in general. The story of the savings and loan crisis was exactly this tilt away from what are the typical investment policies of a savings bank into these riskier loans in ways that this large collection of depositors is probably unaware of. And in the 1980s and 90s, when the savings and loans crisis happened, we had a much larger safety net for these sorts of things so that accounts that were insured could be made whole. And so there was still, you know, disruption, but you didn't completely lose out. And that is, I think, effectively what happened with the savings bank. So in its early years, it was a very traditional savings bank, taking in deposits, putting them into things like government bonds. And then as time goes on, the overhead expenditures of the bank become unwieldy. The expansion of the bank becomes too rapid. Just the sort of elements of the bank and the people who are involved in the bank who were willing to cut corners, who were willing to do things that, you know, that were borderline fraudulent, if not fraudulent, began changing the investment policy of the bank. And in doing so, the bank was headquartered in Washington, D.C. In doing so, made these very large individual investments in Washington, D.C. real estate. And that is fine under ordinary economic conditions. And you just paper over what's going on because everything is going up. And then when the Panic of 1873 happens, mm-hmm. all of that gets wiped out. And they manage to weather the initial Panic of 1873 and go into reorganization. And no less than Frederick Douglass was appointed as chair of this committee to try and reorganize the Freedmen's Bank. But the damage was just too large. And the bank had to essentially be resolved in the summer of 1874. And it was resolved by essentially a very large government resolution project, which again was unusual at the time.
I want to get to the resolution project in a minute, but do you feel that the challenges that come, you know, with any savings and loan, as you said, institution, but do you think that there was something with the Freedmen's Bank that had to do because it involved the formerly enslaved and because it involved U.S. colored troops that made the situation a little different. What I mean by that is that I have read that a lot of it was due because they felt as though the formerly enslaved could not manage themselves. They needed someone to kind of be their sort of manager, savior, or whatever, which is why perhaps later on they didn't bring in Frederick Douglass until it was at its breaking point. Do you think those thoughts about the formerly enslaved had something to do with their ability to feel free to mismanage it and have corruption become part of the strategy, or I guess not strategy, but become part of the bank, I should say?
Yeah, I mean, that's a really good question. And I think there's an open debate about that. And it's a debate that I think I try to remain a little bit agnostic about. You know, I think that there are people who incorrectly believe that the entire thing was more or less above board, and then it just sort of had a bad hit. And there are people who think that the whole thing was just rotten to its core from 1865. You know, I personally don't know that I split the difference, but I do think that, you know, at least from an intentions standpoint, I don't think that it sort of began as an intentional scam to defraud African Americans. I don't think that that's quite fair. And I also think that, you know, that savings banks are sort of generically thought of as tools for, you know, people who are disenfranchised, who are not as high in the social hierarchy, to get a leg up by essentially just being able to take small amounts of money and have access to parts of the financial economy that you're otherwise barred from. And I don't think that should be discounted. At the same time, and I think that this is part of what I think that the paper is trying to get, that risk that you are taking advantage of your depositor base, and that all of these things always happen by degrees. It's always the sort of small choices that get made at the margins where, you know, this would be fine. And I'm sure that, you know, we'll just do this once and then it'll get better. And, you know, that those problems are certainly much more severe in a population like the newly freed slaves that were the customers of the Freedmen's Bank. Mm-hmm. And that it's important to understand the ways in which financial institutions are uniquely susceptible to those exact kinds of problems. Mm-hmm. That whatever your opinion on the, you know, the goals and the intentions of the people involved in the enterprise, the mere structure of the enterprise is certainly conducive to that. And again, whatever your beliefs are, that has to be taken seriously. It's not something that you can ignore. It wasn't something that should have been ignored then, which it kind of was. And it's not something that can be ignored today.
Hmm. Dr. Worlaw, you mentioned your paper, and it's entitled Societal Trust and Financial Market Participation, Evidence from the Freedmen's Savings Bank. Can you describe a little bit more kind of what the paper is about for the listeners?
Sure. So the paper has these sort of two parts. They're sort of separated chronologically, and then we try to bind them together into a coherent message about not merely the Freedmen Savings and Trust, but again, any sort of financial institution that is set up by policy to try and assist disenfranchised populations. The first end of the paper is about broad participation and about the accumulation of new deposits and how that kind of behavior reacts to the kind of civil unrest and racial violence that was occurring at the time. And one of the things that we find is that when you have these periods of serious racial violence, which was pretty endemic in the South at the time, that banks that were sort of closer in which there was a more lived experience of these sorts of things, we're much more likely to see a decline in new deposits, and that this seems to happen across the board. And that alternatively, in times in which there were positive events for the African-American population, things like the ascension of PBS Pinchback to the governorship of Louisiana, which who became the first Black governor in any state in the Union, things like the Declaration of the Enforcement Acts by President Grant, which declared martial law and set in South Carolina, that those things actually caused an increase in new deposits for branches in that particular area. And so the goal of this is essentially to talk about, okay, if you have a financial enterprise that exists as a savings bank, what is it that sort of determines trust in that institution and the willingness to make new deposits? And is it affected by these broader things in society that are happening that erode the trust in public institutions more generally, in the ability of the government to keep people safe and to have their long-term interests in mind? And that when those things happen, people stop depositing in the bank. Now, you know, what impact that is in a long-term basis, we'll get to, but it certainly speaks to the idea that if you have an institution that is trying to help people, there's this rather terrible feedback in which if you're not protecting the populations in a broad sense, and that broadly speaking, that these populations don't have trust in the ability of the government to protect them and to give them lives that are equivalent to the rest of the population, that these experiments are more likely to fail in general. And then the second half of the paper is kind of investigating, well, you know, conditional on that, how do these ideas of trust, in other words, who is it who stays with the bank when the end starts to come? So again, the full scope of the problems in the Freedmen's Savings and Trust weren't broadly known to the population at large until 1974. And bank runs were just an unbelievably common experience prior to the establishment of the FDIC and the Federal Reserve. And so you have these institutions that effectively rely on the trust of their depositors to remain financially solvent. You know, that trust is, I think, you know, in the end, not warranted. And what is it that you know, that appears to create differentials amongst the people who will pull their money out of these demand deposit accounts and the people who will just get stuck in the bitter end and get left holding the bag? It's the single most striking and serious result in the paper, which is that there was a small population of white depositors, maybe 10, you know, depending on where you were, 10 or more percent of the depositors who were white, who were just there because the dividend payouts to the depositors were, you know, reasonably competitive, and it was a, you know, a place to stash your money. That if you were white, you were simply twice as likely to bail on the bank and get out with 100% of your money than if you were black. And that's, I mean, that's extraordinarily damning. It means that there is both a lack of information, perhaps, and a sort of differential, you know, there's not a compensating distrust of the system more broadly that protects these disenfranchised groups who don't know as much from these kinds of failures. And mm-hmm. sort of whatever the impact of the bank on its citizens, you know, on the depositors might have been during its operation, the failure disproportionately wipes out the exact groups of people that, you know, had the most invested in the project in the first place. So not just black people, but people who were local to the community, older people who are more likely to essentially be at the end of their working life and not being able to recover these sorts of things. These are the people who end up staying and getting hurt by the enterprise, the people who can at least afford it in a way.
So one question you kind of bring to the point of the end of the bank, and one of the questions I get sometimes at genealogy conferences, which I don't know how to answer, you know, someone has had an ancestor who was a depositor in the Freedmen's Bank, and they want to know how to get their money back. And I think a lot of that has to do, and it's not funny, but I think a lot of it has to do with not really understanding kind of what actually happened, right?
Sure.
Like, yeah, I feel like, you know, in having this conversation with you, I'm learning so much, but also even, you know, generations later, we still don't know, right? Until we dig into projects like yours or look at the committee reports. So essentially, you know, it seems to me that that's not even an option, right? That it was, what's gone is gone. Is that correct?
One of the interesting things more broadly about this is just how late in the congressional record there are still demands by politicians, by senators and congressmen to argue for making these depositors whole. I mean, this goes well into the 20th century. And, you know, I think at the time there was this pushback in the sense that, well, you know, the bank was, you know, it was just a private bank. These things fail. Other people have been involved in failed banks and they, you know, they didn't get fully repaid. You know, this is just a fact of life or whatever. But, you know, I think that, you know, particularly the people who are advancing this in the congressional record, they rightfully understand that this is a different thing, that you've created an enterprise for people who were just entering the economic system to begin with. Mm-hmm. And, you know, you allowed them to be part of this enterprise and then, you know, without any of the sort of understanding or equipment necessary to guard against the risks of those enterprise, which were substantial, you know, even aside from the progressive amounts of what could be considered fraud that were going on later on. And that, you know, that has to be accounted for. In terms of the payouts and the resolutions more generally, so one of the things that we did for the project, and one of the things I think that it was kind of coolest thing, was that we went and we digitized the dividend payout records themselves. So there are giant books full of, you know, cursive writing that list every single depositor for a large number of banks, or large number of branches, I should say, who were there at the end. The deposit, you know, the cumulative deposit balances essentially match the books of the branches. So it was everybody. And I mean, some very large percentage of people, and the deposit record shows this, never petitioned to be repaid. So, you know, the government ended up, as they resolved the bank, as they unwound the bad loans, they paid out the depositors some percentage on the dollar. I forget exactly what it is. I should look this up. I think it's 60 some odd cents on the dollar. But an extraordinarily large percentage of those depositors who were there, who are there in the books, they never bothered to claim it. You had to send in your passbook in order to deem, you know, in order to redeem it, to get paid something. And, you know, I think particularly because African-American populations at the time were much harder to get a hold of, that they were, you know, much more widely scattered, that they didn't understand the financial system as well as well as other groups, just because they were new, mm-hmm. You know, to these systems, that they just never got a chance to claim any of their money. I don't know what the status of it is. I've sort of spoken to people and read certain things about kind of what the open status of it is. It's one of those things where, you know, I always wondered why there wasn't a renewed push to make good on this particular project, you know? Mm-hmm. You know, the accounts and the sort of impassioned pleas that you read about in the congressional record in the early 20th centuries they're moving. And, you know, and I think that, again, like I said, this, you know, this argument that gets made that, oh, well, you know, as a private bank, you know, everybody gets hurt when these private banks would go under in the 19th century. That's just the way that it was. I don't think those track. I mean, this is exactly the problem, that mm-hmm. you have people who, through no fault of their own, you know, were removed from the things that allowed them to integrate into modern society. And we tried to, you know, to bring them into society, and, you know, we screwed up. Mm-hmm. And we should take that seriously.
Right. I think as you were explaining that or answering the question, what came to mind for me was, you know, 1874, we're seeing now kind of, and depending on where you are in the South, the federal troops pulling out, you know, of the Freedmen's Bureau, some kind of shutting down. And so there's not their protection. And you also have, you mentioned and talked about the violence, but you also have the rise of the KKK and violence against the freedmen that went on throughout this time period. So I wonder if part of the reluctance to even try to go and get your funds, right, to try to pursue that was maybe I just need to survive at this point, right? You know, I'm fresh out of slavery, basically, you know, we're 10 years out, 11 years out, and I'm sorry, like less than that, 9 years out. But
yeah, that's right.
Yeah. And that, you know, I'm just trying to survive here. But one of the questions I had to go back to the research, and you mentioned, Dr. Warlaw, about the dividend records that you had that you digitized. There's also a couple other records you use in your research that I want you to address. The Freedmen's Bank passbooks, and then the indices to the new accounts. Can you describe sort of, for genealogical research purposes, those would be very important to us, but can you describe each of those resources?
Sure. So let me start with the indices to the new accounts, in part because I do want to highlight the extraordinary work that was done by FamilySearch.org. Again, like I said, I listened to your interview with Tom. We owe an enormous debt of gratitude to his work. So those records have all essentially been transcribed, and FamilySearch actually made available to us the records in one large data table, which, you know, as an economics researcher is kind of centrally important. We look at things in large data aggregates, and it's not quite as useful to try and track down people individually. And so once we had those, we had to do an extraordinary amount of work essentially trying to clean it, because it's a loosely organized collection of records. And so we did a lot of computational work, essentially figuring out where all of the gaps are, figuring out where the sequencing is, figuring out which record represents a new deposit and which record represents an administrative entry to, you know, to flip account numbers or something like that. There's quite a bit of that. And so, you know, so for that, the work that we essentially did was in sort of trying to rectify and clean a lot of those records and to create a comprehensive program that turns one, you know, those collected records into something that is cleaner and easier to use for researchers, and thoroughly goes in and documents where the limitations are. So, you know, where do you get good, solid, contiguous records? Where do you get, these records are probably kind of, you know, bad, and you know, you might be able to track down a couple of people, but it wouldn't be particularly useful from an analytic standpoint. So that's what we did there. And again, an enormous amount of gratitude to FamilySearch for allowing us, for giving us the permission to use the data in that collected form. On our website, we've sort of made links to all of it and then made kind of a list of our extensive documentation on the subject. So if people are interested in that, that kind of gives you a pathway to that. The second thing, and this is really what started the project in the first place, are these passbook records. And there's 300 or 400 of them or so. And they're actually transaction logs. So for people who are old enough to remember, when you had a savings account, you used to have a paper passbook and you would make a documentation of, you know, your deposits and your withdrawals. But particularly back in the 1800s, this was actually a much more central part of the process, that your passbook existed in a way as a means of identifying yourself. You didn't have an ID, that this was, you know, the person who bore the passbook was the account holder. And so those, like I said, were initially on this microfilm that was a poor copy, and we had difficulty transcribing it. So we actually went to the National Archives and took high quality photographs of all of the account records and tried to actually complete the microfilm, which was missing a handful of records, and then went through and digitized not just the names, not just the sort of details about the people that were contained in the passbook, but their full list of transactions. Mm-hmm. And then kind of pushed that, both the data and the images, onto the project that we're doing. And then finally, as I mentioned before, the dividend records, which were just recently made available by the Comptroller of the Currency through the St. Louis Fed. And it is a giant bound book that is a list of names, along with the final amounts that were on deposit when the bank closed, and a list of dividend payments if and when they were made. So essentially who claimed their money. You know, with that, just kind of as a function of the funds we had available to us, we digitized the number of the account so that we could make a direct connection to the indices to new accounts. We didn't write down the names themselves, simply because that's a much more labor-intensive process that we didn't quite have the funds for. Hopefully someone will be interested in it. Certainly, because we have linked the numbers to the passbooks, we can link the names there. But the records exist. They're very well documented, and they're very well written. So those are available there. And again, you know, much credit to the Comptroller of the Currency and the St. Louis Fed for making those available. One thing that we did do was we re-encoded them into a less processor intensive resolution format, so you could scrub them a little bit easier. Even on a very fast computer, the way that they're encoded on the OCCs from the OCC is hard to scrub through. So, you know, if nothing else, you can, from our project, you can get a set of image records that's easier to scrub through.
Well, we appreciate that. As genealogists, of course, names are important to us. So hopefully with those dividend records down the road, we'll be able to make that link to your project. I have another question, because we talked about these reports. And I know the reports of the Select Committee of the Freedmen Savings and Trust, and they went well into, or I guess the police, you said, well into the 20th century. Were those reports helpful in kind of understanding the background of the story of what was going on, and sort of who had the most kind of, who seemed to have the most interest in making the depositors whole who had lost their funds?
Yeah, so that's a great question. So these congressional records are, I mean, very expansive. They are extraordinarily expansive. It is worth emphasizing the importance that the failure and the resolution of this bank had within the government and future Republican administrations at the time. This was something that was huge and something that a lot of people, I think, cared very deeply about. It. This was not something where, you know, the government just didn't care and then they let things go. You read really harrowing testimony about, you know, various aspects of the bank. You read these audit reports from auditors who were auditing the bank who have no shortage of words for, you know, what they perceived as deficiencies and quite fraudulent behavior sometimes on the part of people running some branches of the bank. And so it's extraordinarily helpful just from a context standpoint. I think especially for us, and you know, this is maybe of less interest to your audience, especially for us as economics researchers, just because, you know, you read historical accounts, some of which are based on snippets from the historical records. But for us, it was extraordinarily important to understand the status of the banks and the evolution of the banks from an accounting standpoint. And the audits are extraordinarily detailed. And so both from a numerical standpoint and from a commentary standpoint, it's extraordinary. To your question about who it was who was speaking out about these things, again, it was, you know, by and large, you know, it was politicians in the Republican administration at the time who cared a lot about this. You know, this, as you just mentioned, this was not that long after the Civil War, and there were a lot of people in the administration who felt that they had fought long and hard from, you know, before 1861 to make things right, and that, you know, things had gone wrong, and that they had a moral obligation to make it right.
You know, the kind of to your point about the research that you do in the audits, while it may not be something that the average genealogist would take a look at, I think it does help, because I always talk about putting your ancestor in kind of in historical context, right? And this is a big part of, you know, our history, part of American history, Reconstruction. And we don't spend, enough time on it. And, you know, my motivation for and having you on the podcast was to learn more about this for my own education, but also to understand what I'm looking at when I see a past, a passbook or I see a dividend record, right? And knowing how many branches and understanding how, you know, how this was unusual. This wasn't the norm when it started, you know, and the growth of the bank. But I want to get to, we talked a little bit about, well, we talked about the collapse of the bank in 1874 and bringing in Frederick Douglass. You know, what role did he play in sort of, in your research? Have you kind of uncovered any of his words or thoughts about the bank while he was part of it?
You know, and this is not unique to what we've done, obviously. It's one of the sort of central pointed facts about the end of the bank is that no less than Frederick Douglass was, you know, was appointed to head the resolution committee. And he doesn't speak that much in the records. But when he does speak, it is with this sort of profound sense of loss. You know, I think that he, you know, at least from his words, he believed in the broader context of the enterprise. You know, if you read his, you know, his second autobiography in particular, you know, Frederick Douglass was, I mean, it's impossible to overstate, right? He's one of the most extraordinary Americans. It's silly to even try to say anything else. But he was a man who believed passionately in politics, you know, and in making America right. And that's why he was there. He didn't just get, you know, put in place because, oh, here's this guy and, you know, maybe we can assign him, you know, and that'll sort of put a sheen on this thing. Certainly the optics mattered, but he was a guy who was deeply involved in politics because he was deeply committed to the ongoing project of making things right. And so, the things that he sort of talks about and the kind of lost, the lost opportunities and the lost potential, you can tell that it sort of deeply affected him.
I can understand that given what I've read about him, but I wanted to make that point because I think it's important for genealogists to understand who was all involved in the Freedmen's Bank, but also with your project and the records that you have and the paper that you've worked on, how would you advise genealogists, you know, who don't necessarily have the same background, a financial background or studying economics, to use the information that you have, and we'll definitely put a link into the website with the resources, but how to use those resources to help advance their family history and uncover their ancestors.
So I can speak to this in a, perhaps in a direct way. I was part of a symposium at the University of Georgia that was a specific symposium on slavery and the impacts of slavery in Athens and on the community at UGA. Mm-hmm. And again, my research area and background is perhaps a little bit far from the types of historians who normally participate in these kinds of things. But as part of that presentation of that project, I went into the records and tried to collect all of the people that I could find who had some sort of local roots within the Athens community. And and there are, you know, a not insignificant number of names that that have long roots into the present. And, you know, in fact, you can go to an old graveyard in Athens and track down the headstones of a handful of the people who are, you know, either were relatives of the people who are specifically mentioned in some of these historical records. And some of them, this is their only listing. They don't show up in the census, maybe, you know, maybe some of the relatives do. They don't show up anywhere else, at least, you know, to the extent that I can find. I'm not a professional genealogist, but they show up here. And then, you know, through a little bit of work, you can find a lot more about who they were, and not only that, but where their final resting place. And I think that you're exactly right, that it's not just about a name and a location and the fact that, you know, great-great-great-grandfather was a certain person in a certain place, but that there's a context to who they were. I would sometimes find a name in the city registries, which was a phone book before you had phones. And you saw that a person was, you know, a smith or a, you know, or a housekeeper or whatever, and that their brother lived in Athens and probably had money sent to them and came to rest in this sort of final place. You know, that graveyard, I think, too, is particularly poignant because it's been abandoned for a while. I mean, it's still marked, but it's, you know, it's a remarkable thing. And I think I've come to appreciate, I wasn't necessarily before this project, I think a huge fan of genealogy. I don't think I thought much about it one way or another, but you know, I'm serious. In the context of this project, I get it. Genealogy is not just about who your relatives are and what their job is, but a context for who they were, what they experienced, and you know, how that informs the probably multiple centuries of, you know, attitudes and ideas and traditions that get, you know, that make you who you are.
I really appreciate you saying that, because, and that's why I was kind of smiling there, because that's one of the things that I've been working on, is kind of trying to bridge the gap between genealogists and historians in a way, because the research, as evidenced by this conversation, the research that you do, the research that you've done, and things you may do in the future are essential in helping us find our people, especially when you talked about doing the research for that, I think you said symposium you were part of at UGA, going to the cemetery, actually doing the additional work in preparation for that, kind of led you into some of the genealogical things that we do. And that data that you collect is so important for us, because a good point that you brought up was around, they may be listed only in that one document, in that maybe they're just in that, you know, deposit record or in the passbook, and they're not listed anywhere else. And that helps us tie them to a particular area during Reconstruction if they died prior to the 1870 census, right? So we talk about the 1870 brick wall, whereas once we get beyond the 1870 census, how do we find our formerly enslaved ancestors? And this is one way to do that. So I appreciate that statement, and I appreciate your work. And I just have one last question for you, Dr. Wardlaw. Sort of what's next in your research, and with, you know, are you planning on expanding this particular project down the road?
Yeah, I mean, that's a really good question. So we're still trying to get the paper published. It's in economics, it's one of those things where the lead time on these kind of publication processes is extraordinarily long. You know, part of the reason why we made a decision last year to just make a lot of facets of the project publicly available as more than just a paper was we wanted to make our efforts useful. There's a lot of things that go on the cutting room floor of a research paper. And, you know, if nothing else, we wanted someone to get value out of the research that we've done. There is, I think, a lot more to do. I think particularly the dividend records, and someone has brought this up at a conference, that there's sort of very interesting work to be done on who it is that successfully collects some of what they're owed from these kind of government resolutions and who doesn't. And, you know, I thought what you said a little while back was quite salient, that, you know, and you notice this if you try to sort of track people down in the 1880 census, that people are scattered to the four winds. And it's mm-hmm. not surprising that, you know, when you're trying to sort of eke out an existence in a place that is not keeping you safe, this might fall to the back of your concerns.
Well, thank you so much, Dr. Wardlaw, for taking time today to be part of this podcast. I do feel like a lot of your work and what you've done with your colleague is extremely important, helping us understand the financial impact of the Freedmen's Savings and Trust, the Freedmen's Bank, both with the establishment of it and the failure of it, and then how that fits in the broader picture of our ancestors trying to be integrated into the South, former Confederacy, as free people and citizens of the United States. So I really appreciate your work. And I also want to thank you very much for making your work, your research available prior to publication, because it's often very difficult to get that core data that goes into a paper. So I really appreciate that. And we'll make sure that a link is included to your work.
Thank you so much, Neil. I really appreciate it. This was it was a great interview. Thank you so much.
Conversations with Kenyatta is produced by Kenyatta D. Berry and Caitlin Owl and features Kenyatta D. Berry. The music for this episode was Good Vibe by Ketza. Follow Kenyatta on Instagram under the handle kenyatta.berry, on Facebook at facebook.com/kenyattadb, and on Twitter at kenyattadb. You can also find more information on her book and upcoming events on her website at kenyattaberry.com.